Welcome, everybody, to the Sagebrush Shit Show, the beginning of a new era. Season 2, Episode 1, Sam Jackson in the house, Clint motherfreaking Bisbee is in the house. We've got so much top quality content for you guys. Clint, I hope you had a great summer. I know you've got some hot takes. The people are ready to hear them. It's going to be a great year, you guys. As you all may know, old listeners may recognize my voice. If you're a new listener, my name is, once again, Sam Jackson, USU student, everybody's student advocate, you know, out here advocating for you folks. Come see me in my office hours. It's a good time. Roommates with my good friend Clint here. I'm a hardcore Democrat. Clint is a card-carrying fascist, I mean Republican.
Oh.
Clint, do you want to go ahead and give just a brief introduction about all things Bisbee?
Yeah. All right, so I'm from Clearfield, Utah originally, and as
the greatest
Sam,
city,
the greatest city in America. We recently breached the 30,000 marks in terms of population. So you might say we're the best. In fact, on Sunday, I got up and bore my testimony about how much I love my hometown a little bit. It was kind of like that. You can ask TJ Hawes, one of our other roommates, but it was pretty amazing.
Sure it was.
I worked for Ogden City this summer.
How wonderful.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Government, am I right?
The government. I hate the government. No, but seriously, it was a really great opportunity. I'm a political science and economics major. This will be my last year. I like freedom, unlike my co-host. So yeah, it will be nice to have some freedom lovers on this show now.
You know, Clint, it's always good to hear your voice. I'll try, you know, folks, I'm going to try not to lose my temper at this man.
It happens a lot.
Just last night, we got into a heated debate about whether or not race is a social construct. I'm sure we'll bring it up again.
You know, we're about on the same side. It was Brayden who was...
Come see, come saw.
But shout out also to the gentleman who I'm taking over for, Grant Bess. Absolutely. Was last year's host. He is out on deployment currently, and we are... The United Arab Emirates.
So wish him well. I know he's listening.
And we are very grateful for all he does for this country. We really are.
Absolutely. And, you know, we hope to get him on maybe as a guest sometime during the year. If you want to hear Grant talk for 20 minutes straight about student fees, please check out last season. On that note, let's go ahead and move into some sports.
Let's do it.
Last week,
the Aggies.
I'm sure everyone listening to this was at the USU football watch party. It was a great time. USU took on the Michigan State Spartans, perennial powerhouse, ranked number 11 in the country. I don't remember who the writer was from the Statesman, but they predicted that USU would lose like 55-13.
We lost by 7.
Ended up being a really tight game. We had the lead by 1 with 5 minutes to go. Michigan State made some great plays down the stretch, and it was a really close game. Upset alert was on. USU unfortunately couldn't pull it out in the end. Similar to a lot of different games we've had, we lost by 1 or 2 to Auburn 3 or 4 years ago, lost to USC. We've played some really tight games against some really big teams in the past, so it's hard to say whether or not this means anything going forward. USU has kind of a cupcake schedule this year. A lot of easy home games. We've got New Mexico State.
Although we lost to them at the bowl.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a winnable game. It's a game we should win at home.
Right.
And our kicker did miss like 5 field goals in the game. And then we've got Tennessee Tech next week, I think. So, and Colorado State is not nearly what they were last year.
Is it just me, or is like any college that has Tech at the end, are they usually like they aren't ever good at sports? Like 95% of the time.
Georgia Tech.
Well, yeah, but like there's Georgia, but like
Texas Tech has been good. Virginia Tech is always good.
I know, but like.
So I mean, I don't know how strong the argument is.
I guess. So actually, when we're talking
about Utah Tech, but.
So we were. There is no Utah Tech. Oh, yeah, there's Bridgeland. And there's the Davis Applied Technical College. So I saw this tweet, or I heard about this tweet, and it was talking about, you know, Utah football in general. And it was kind of talking about how, you know, the Ute fans were freaking out and the Y fans were freaking out about, you know, how their seasons have started off. But it was like, you know, Utah State sees their team go toe-to-toe with number 11. They don't win, and they just take a drink and nod their head understandingly. So it's not like we're not used to it.
We are absolutely, absolutely used to it.
But they played well. I thought they played well.
They did play well and gave fans some hope. And it was fun while it lasted.
It was.
I remember we had to leave the watch party early to go to a dinner, and we were down at I can't remember.
It was like a grill.
The grill over by Blue Square. I can't remember the name of it. We were at the end of dinner. It's the fourth quarter, and my friend leans over to me and is like, yo, USU is up by one right now. And so we all got up, went into the bar and watched the game. So it was great for the fans, and I hope the season ends up well. Could see us going 8-4, 7-5. Could be a good year. Yeah. Next, let's move on to
a
how shall we say?
A one-sided argument for me. That's what it is. I mean, because I'm right and you're wrong. So, for our listeners, we're going to be discussing whether or not the sequel Star Wars movies I don't have a problem with Episode 7. My main beef is with Episode 8 versus the prequels.
Let's back up a little bit. Clint and I recently have been engaging into an argument over whether the prequel Star Wars movies are better. For those who don't know, Episodes 1 through 3, Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, Revenge of the Sith,
right?
Versus Episode 7 and 8...
Last Jedi and Force Awakens.
Force Awakens.
We got that backwards, but
now, we put out a poll on our Sagebrush.
Oh, and did we?
Our Sagebrush Show Twitter. I don't know if you saw it, Clint. And episodes 7 and 8 did win, 59% to 41%.
I mean, Hitler was popular.
Whoa! That's a hot take. Now... I will say this. The 41% of you that voted for episodes 1 to 3, I don't trust you. I'm sorry.
You don't trust us. I don't trust you.
Now, allow me to give my take.
Okay, let's hear your take.
And I feel like this is more of a mainstream take.
Oh, mainstream.
And I'll go into the... Hold on. I'll go into the cultural implications of this argument as well later.
I'll let you take your take. I just want to say, the mainstream take, that's what Democrats will always call their takes,
anyways,
is that it's the mainstream.
Because they are.
Okay.
The mainstream media, right?
Is that right.
Anyways. So, Episode 2 of the Star Wars franchise trilogy.
Attack of the Clones, first one with Hayden Christensen.
Attack of the Clones is a disgrace. It is a smear on the windshield. It is a disgusting excuse.
Wait,
for
a
me.
Sneer?
A smear.
Oh, I thought you said a sneer. I was like, how does a windshield? Okay, anyway, so it's bad.
It is bad. Hayden Christensen, by all accounts, not a horrible actor. Other films, I don't know if I've seen him in a ton of other films, but the general consensus seems to be that he's a decent actor. In episodes 2 and 3, he is absolutely terrible. And there's no denying that fact. Natalie Portman, I love Natalie Portman. She is atrocious. In episodes 1, 2, and 3, emotionless, just kind of seems like she's not there, right? I love you, Annie. What will I ever do without you, Annie? I cannot do it. Let me get to episode 1 really quick.
Okay.
Episode 1. Jar Jar Binks and Sebulba are two of the worst characters.
Not as bad as Rose.
Oh, please. I'll get to that in a second.
He'll get to that in a second.
Sebulba and Jar Jar Binks, again, a disgrace to the Star Wars franchise, absolutely ruined the movies. The child actor that played Anakin was terrible, was too naive, was too happy-go-lucky. I can't do it. I just couldn't do it. And let me get to episode 7 and 8. Yes, there are flaws. And I did agree, 7, while the plot, I don't think, was as good, I think that the overall quality of the movie was probably better. Because I just think they stole the plot from episode 4 and episode 7, so I'll give it that. But episode 8, man, just all the moments that they pull the heartstrings, puppet Yoda showing up, that emotional response cannot be replicated. And I'll give you that there are a lot of humorous moments that don't need to be there. I'll agree that Luke tossing the lightsaber away probably was not one of my favorite scenes. The opening scene where it's Poe talking about the colonel's mom or whatever it was. Again, not one of my favorite scenes. But overall, a great film and far and away better than any of the prequel films. You may now have your turn.
Okay, let's dive in. First of all, you can't blame Hayden Christensen, Natalie Portman, or any of them for some of their bad acting in line. That all goes to the writers and, quite frankly, to George Lucas. Okay, Jar Jar Binks may be a horrible character. I will agree with you. It
Williams.
It's pointless.
It is.
I can't stand him.
You're right.
However, episode one doesn't waste 45 minutes on the uselessness of Jar Jar Binks, unlike in episode eight. But I'll get to that. Episodes one, two, and three have Ewan McGregor, who quite arguably is the greatest actor of our century. Have you seen that man? Have you seen that man act? There are so many great one-liners from him. I have the high ground, Anakin. Don't try it.
Please continue. I can't. Is that all you have to say?
No, it's not.
Get to Rose, please. Everyone.
Episodes one, two, and three create a beautiful, interesting, complicated plot line that sets up the original trilogy excellently.
What a poor take.
No, it's not a poor take. Episode 1 and 2, we have no idea who the Sith Lord is. And then at the end of the third movie, you finally realize that it was Chancellor Palpatine, a Sith Lord the whole time, who's secretly infiltrating. And we see...
You didn't see that coming?
I didn't. Not the first time I saw it. Come on. Don't... Come on, son.
Let me finish.
All right? It's also about the naivety of the Jedi. Even Yoda was blinded by this idea of the Jedi Code. And arguably, if Qui-Gon Jinn hadn't been killed, Anakin never would have turned to the dark side. Because he was flexible in the Jedi Code. Now, let's go to the sequels. Episode 7 is kind of weak. We'll put it as weak. I like Episode 7. I thought it did really good job of introducing an amazing new main character, main hero, Rey. I thought it did. It pulled a lot on classic Star Wars. Sam's writing something and I don't. Anyway, it was weak, but it's also safe in that it serves up to the next director, Rian Johnson, a great starting point. J.J. Abrams did amazing in that sense. Rian Johnson then came in and butchered the Star Wars franchise. And let me tell you how. First of all, the Rose character is arguably the worst character to have ever appeared. It's not a bad take. Jar Jar Binks is terrible in the sense that, like, he's a pointless character. But Rose, we spend 45 minutes on. I don't want to watch 45 minutes of her. And then at the end, there's this forced love story between her and Finn that was the worst.
Why is that forced?
It was forced. Honestly, I got no sense of them being attracted to one another until at the very end when she kisses him and says that stupid line, we don't win by destroying what we hate. We win by saving what we love. What do you mean? That's how war works. You have to destroy what you hate. Do you think if we had just loved each other during World War II, the Nazis would have disappeared? No.
Why is everything about Nazis with you?
You're the one who calls me a fascist.
Jeez, you always bring it there. Continue. Sorry.
Never mind. Anyway.
Always.
Rose and the Poe and Finn story, all that detracted from the main hero of the story, which is Rey. That movie pulled away so much from Rey, who is the main character, who has amazing depth that they could have explored, but they wasted so much time on other characters who were secondary to her. Second of all, I will give a really good compliment to that movie in that Luke Skywalker has kind of seen the bad part of the Jedi. And even of the Sith, in that they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And this harkens back to the prequels, where, you know...
Agreed, that's the genius of the eighth movie.
But they executed it horribly.
How did they execute it horribly?
First of all, throwing his lightsaber. Come on, you even admit that was a bad thing.
I agree, but the rest of it was great.
No, it's not. It sets it up for failure. If I have to watch Luke Skywalker throw a lightsaber, it was awful. Some of the other forced humor, like Luke like tickling Rey's hand, it's the Force. That was stupid. Come on. That's not Luke. Luke Skywalker is the guy who destroyed both Death Stars.
Okay. First of all, let me get to my take.
Let me
address your last point there, okay? Let's not act like Luke Skywalker was some hard ass that was, you know, just set on destroying the Empire. That's not the case.
He was
a happy-go-lucky pilot from Tatooine, who had nothing, that just jumped into the rebellion. Now, hold on. Now, let me address your other points here. First of all, your most prevalent argument, and arguably your most convincing, was the strength of the plot of the prequels, right? Now, yes, I agree that it was a great plot line. Executed terribly, a great plot line. But those same stories are still happening in the sequels. We still don't know who Rey's parents are. We still don't know. We didn't know the relationship between Kylo and Rey until this last movie. We still don't know who Snoke is. Who the hell is Snoke?
Snoke, that was another thing. What the hell was with Snoke?
We don't know.
He was stupid.
We don't know.
He appears in the seventh movie for maybe 2 minutes, and then we kill him in the eighth?
We don't know.
What?
We don't know.
It was supposed to be like a discount emperor?
Anyways, you're also totally missing the symbolism in the eighth movie.
Oh, I'm missing the symbolism.
You are.
Missing the symbolism.
Rose symbolizes. She symbolizes...
bad character?
She symbolizes the spirit of the rebellion. And if you remember at the end of the movie...
It's the resistance.
Whatever, man.
They're rebels.
Are they not rebels?
They're resisting the First Order.
Do you remember Emperor Palpatine? And he's like... You will crush your pitiful little resistance. Or rebellion, excuse me.
Yeah, see? Rebellion versus...
It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
Anyway.
Anyways.
The spirit of the resistance.
That's what she symbolizes. Finn was about to dip. He's about to get on that escape pod and just get the hell out of here. And look who kept him. It was Rose who kept him.
But why did it have to be... Why couldn't it be Finn? I mean, Poe, excuse me. Why couldn't it be Poe? We already established that greater relationship. Why do we need to bring in another character?
I understand that it went on too long, and I agree.
Also, the horses on that planet, like the horse things with the bunny ears.
Right.
Anyway, we're going to agree to disagree.
We'll move on. Sorry if you don't like Star Wars. We just wasted about 15, 20 minutes of your life.
Talking about Star Wars.
I need to vent about that. Please give us your hot takes. Vote on the poll if you haven't already.
I
don't know if those or not. But
if not, we'll post another
rules,
one.
And we...
Majority doesn't rule. We live in a republic, not a democracy. That's another great line from the prequels. I love democracy. When Palpatine is getting the emperorship. There we go.
Let's move on.
The next thing we're going to talk about is the Massachusetts primary.
Jump right into politics.
Yeah, we're going to jump right in. And tell me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, saying Mike Capuano?
Capuano, excuse me.
So we're going to talk about how he lost the primary, and he has been in the House of Representatives for 10 years, and he lost to a progressive insurgent in his primary. So it's not going to just be talking about him, but also kind of about this progressive insurgency that we've seen in American politics. So
now,
Sam, what are your thoughts?
Yes. So let me draw a parallel. Obviously, most people draw it to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is it Alexandria or Alexandria? I don't remember.
I think it's Alexandria.
Okay. Anyways.
If not, we're very sorry.
I think a lot of people are drawing parallels to that race. And that's obviously got, you know, the most attention because Joe Crowley was a prominent figure in the House Democratic Caucus, seen as...
He was minority whip, wasn't he?
No, that's Danny Hoyer, but he was seen as a potential suitor to replace Nancy Pelosi as party leader.
Gotcha.
In the House, anyways. And Mike Capuano, not as big of a name, but it's, again, a symptom of what's been going on over the past years, especially since the 2016 election. And you've seen a lot of these very progressive, a lot of them self-proclaimed Democratic Socialists. Ocasio-Cortez is a self-proclaimed member of the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. And in terms of my opinion on what's happening, I think it's a double-edged sword. On the positive side, I think these days anybody who can get voters excited about a candidate, I think that's genuinely a good thing. I think, you know, if you can relate to a voter, if you can relate to a group of people and have them be excited about the political process, I think that is a good thing. And so I think that's something positive out of this. Now, most of the negatives come towards the Democratic Party. And I think, and I'm sure, Clint, you'll agree with me here, that in many ways, Democratic voters are shooting themselves in the foot because they've created... And now, I have no ill will towards Ocasio-Cortez myself, personally. I think she's great. I think she's entitled to her opinions. Her district fits her district's demographics and their politics, and I think that's what you want in a representative. And that was obviously shown in her primary election. I mean, Crowley had loads more money, loads more advertisements, a 7-term incumbent or something like that. And so mad props to her. On a national scale, however, this is kind of creating somewhat of a boogeyman for Republicans to point to in terms of how they paint Democratic Party. We talked about this in Merrill Scholars yesterday.
We did.
And the branding of the parties and how Republicans, especially since the Obama years, have done an incredible job of painting Democrats as as socialists, as far left, politicians who only care about social issues like abortion and same-sex marriage, and all of those similar types of issues, and out of touch with the common working American. And they've ran with it, and you know, Democrats have, even with now it's about a 9 or 10 point lead, and a generic ballot, you know, it's still about 60-40 proposition whether or not they take back the House. A lot of that is due to gerrymandering and you know, institutional advantages that Republicans have because they control most of state level governments. And I'm not saying the Democrats wouldn't do the same thing if they're in that spot, but I think it's a double-edged sword because it's good to get people excited for politics, but nationally I'm worried about how it portrays the Democratic Party generally. Because, and maybe other people will disagree with me on this, but I think most people do not identify as Democratic Socialists, and this notion that this this hardcore progressivism relates to a majority of Americans, I think, is untrue. Most Americans are conservative. That's just, you know, that's just reality. So, Clint, what do you think?
I think it's a double-edged sword for you, and I think it's like the guy on death row who's going to get hung who pulls the lever himself.
Jeez.
I mean, it's great for me.
That's a hot take.
If you want to pick candidates who are terrible and aren't going to do anything for your party, that's fine by me. The Democrats need to learn that Americans are conservative at the local level and liberal at the national level for the most part. And I think that, you know, that House of Representatives extends to an extent to the local level. Now, obviously, up in the Northeast, Massachusetts, New York, you do have a much more liberal ideology that's prevalent. But still, it inspires Democrats elsewhere, especially places where they are extremely weak. So places like Utah.
Well, but my thing is, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But I think you have to view it through the lens of a pragmatist, right?
Right.
Where, like, for example, sorry to cut you off, but in West Virginia, right? You know, Democrats all across the country are calling for the head of Joe Manchin, right? They despise him. They think he's a fake Democrat, and I sympathize with them to a certain extent, right? You know, he's cuddled up right next to Trump. He's voted with Trump, you know, maybe 30-40% of the time. But
pretty high for a Democrat.
Very high for a Democrat, especially in today's climate. But any way you look at it, voting with Democrats 2/3 of the time is always better than absolutely nothing. It is always better.
Well, that's actually worse for me, but for you it's good.
I'm saying for me, right, in my party. And, you know, nominating these progressives and while also wanting to you can attack the two-party system all you want. But that's the ball game we're playing in. You know, and that's just how government is set up in this country. Now long term, we can look at making institutional changes. But, you know, it's always better to have somebody in your camp than the other. And for someone to say, I'd rather have a Republican in West Virginia than a fake Democrat in Joe Manchin is a horrible, horrible take. And if you're really concerned about producing good good policy outcomes, which I think anyone interested in politics would want to do, I think that's what you should be looking for, is anybody who's willing, if Joe Manchin is willing to be a Democrat and vote with you 2/3 of the time, that's just something you have to live with. Because if he loses his seat, we're not going to see that seat again,
ever,
for 30 years.
West Virginia,
right? So
I'm going to agree with you, but I think it's more of a threat than you're willing to admit, Sam. I really think that if the Democrats, and to a certain extent the Republicans, don't get some of their kind of out there factions under control, they're going to start losing elections left and right. Because if we come to Utah, when inevitably Ben McAdams loses to Mia Love. That's not even like me trying to be funny. I honestly think he'll lose.
I mean, you can say, but to say that it's inevitable.
Okay,
that's not a fair assumption.
I'd put it
at two thirds Mia Love. That's what I'd say.
I wouldn't even say that. I would give her 55%.
So then, why are you saying it's inevitable that Ben McAdams will lose if you only give him?
Because
you
I
only
can
give
see
Mia Love a 55% chance of winning.
No, 55. Never mind.
Sorry, go ahead.
When he loses, the Democrats in Utah are going to start nominating even more far-left individuals.
Well, they've been doing that for years.
Yeah, and what has it brought them? It doesn't win them elections.
I agree. I wholeheartedly agree. Now, you can look at what happened with Misty Snow. And I think Misty Snow is great. I met her. She came up to campus. I think she's an incredible individual.
She never had a chance.
But she never had a chance to win. And maybe we didn't anyways, but the only way that you build trust in your party and create a brand is if you put up Democrat, if you put up candidates that at least can relate to most Americans. In Utah, a transgender cashier, people will not trust someone that fits that demographic as a candidate in the state of Utah. So it's a problem. And if you, and you know, on the other side, with with Republicans, they have a similar issue. You know, you have a lot of these. They're never Trumpers. Really, don't even exist anymore, because
some of us do.
Well, I mean, in terms of elected officials in the House,
right.
They really don't exist anymore. When Trump was elected, there were a few that were kind of wavering. Jeff Flake had his moments. John McCain, rest in peace, had his moments. But they really don't exist anymore. And at the same time, though, the difference between, in my view, the difference between Republicans and Democrats is that Republicans fall in line a lot more easily behind their candidates, no matter who wins. No matter who wins the nomination. And they're much
easier to unite.
I agree with that. I think there are a lot of different reasons for that. I think it's just, the personalities between liberals and conservatives play a factor in that.
I've said this before, but I really think the Democrats are in a much better position for the future than the Republicans are, because both parties have to deal with the fact that lots of things were changed. I mean, Democrats lost to a candidate they should have easily beaten. And so they kind of have to figure out, what are we going to do? Like, how do we balance between our older party membership and also this younger, more progressive party? But then the Republicans, on the other hand, also have to deal with the fact that this candidate, who most Republicans didn't like, is now our president. And I think the Democrats being out of power really gives them a better chance. Whereas with Republicans, we have to stick with Trump to an extent.
Yeah, we can get into that another time. We got to move on.
We do.
We'll come back to this topic.
We're going
to
talk about the greatest Supreme Court nominee in 1,000 years.
Let's touch on this quickly, because I'd like to have a much longer, more nuanced discussion about this.
Right.
Clint, I went first last time, so give me your take on the Kavanaugh situation.
All right. The Republicans are a bunch of hypocrites. I won't lie. They
goddamn right.
They pushed Garland. They pushed him out.
Didn't even have a hearing.
They didn't even have a hearing for him, and although I liked it, it was wrong. It was wrong.
Thank you for admitting that. I appreciate it.
But I also think the Democrats are in a lot of ways shooting themselves in the foot right now.
How?
They need to take the high road. They really do. Because if they don't, then the Republicans, because now the Democrats are using the same strategy, which is only going to create a cycle of the next time that the Democrats have somebody to put up, once they get the White House again,
sure,
it will just be delayed. And we're going to keep delaying our Supreme Court nominations. I think Kavanaugh is an excellent judge choice. If it was under any other circumstance, and if it was any other Republican president, Kavanaugh would have been put through fairly quickly. And a lot of people are saying he's rushed, which isn't true. Now we're 2 days out. Every liberal judge on the Supreme Court, so Stevens, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, they were all approved by now in this process, 66 days in. I think Ginsburg was actually approved in 19 days. So to say that we're rushing this is ridiculous. I think if the Democrats want to win this, because he will be confirmed. Like, I don't see any way that he is not confirmed.
I agree with that.
If they want to win, they need to play the high ground, which I hope they don't. I hope that they keep screaming in committee meetings so Kavanaugh looks even better.
Okay, a lot to get to. I will agree, of course, that they are hypocrites for doing this. Regardless of my personal feelings about Kavanaugh himself, I will say that it puts Senate Democrats in a very, very tough position, especially this being a midterm election year, because you have several red state Democrats who, if they vote no,
They're done.
I'm not going to say that they're done.
Some of them will be.
But it puts them in a very, very tough spot. And I won't say that, I don't know, just kind of the whole process of this has been a little bit off, you know, the decision to release Kavanaugh's, was this 42,000 pages of documents?
You wanted them. The Democrats wanted all the documents.
They did, but to wait until now, until 2 days before, and dump them all at once, you can't say that that's not a little...
They dumped them a couple weeks ago, most of them.
Anyways,
he just passes over that. Just passes over that.
Most of them were just yesterday.
There was a lot dropped yesterday.
The Senate was just given an additional 42,000 pages of Kavanaugh documents the night before his confirmation hearing.
Okay, but...
Come on.
But how many documents did Ruth Bader Ginsburg have? Or Sotomayor? Or any justice that arguably no senator in history has had time to review every single letter that this person... So why are you complaining? Not everybody... We don't read over every document.
Because if you look at Kagan's process when she was nominated, it was a much lengthy... Republicans demanded these documents way ahead of time, and they were given the documents, and she went through a much... Would you disagree with that?
I would, because we're on day 66, which I believe is when Kagan was confirmed.
I'm not talking about the span of time.
Okay.
In which... they were nominated, confirmed, hearing, whatever. I'm talking about the process throughout and the release of these documents.
Okay, but whether it's 40 days or 20 days or 2 days, you're not going to get to go through all these documents.
Tell me there's no difference between 40 days and 2 days or one day.
There is a difference, but when it comes to 21,000 documents, what are you going to find? Like, arguably, you could spend so much time sifting through all that. Who knows?
And you definitely wouldn't disagree with this. This is one of the most important... The Supreme Court is one of the most important institutions in American government.
For sure.
Absolutely. So to say that,
I just think it's funny that we now have to read it before we confirm, whereas before we had to pass it before we could understand and read it.
Oh, my gosh. Let's not...
Hey, not my party.
Well, we want to talk about... we can talk about healthcare.
We'll talk about healthcare another time.
Talk about healthcare another time.
Let's go to Nike Burning.
Very quickly.
Nike Burning. My
Don't
bad.
Don't ever say Nike to me.
Sorry, I just. Again. I'm wearing Nikes now. Remember last year when I guest starred, I had those like off-brand sneakers. Now I have Nikes.
Anyways. I'm just glad they're not Air Monarchs. Goodness gracious. So, I'd like to expand this, Clint, to your feelings about Colin Kaepernick generally. And Nike's endorsement of Colin Kaepernick, and then the response
sure.
to the endorsement.
I don't think Colin Kaepernick's a great football player. I mean, he's all right. I understand
that's
why
not,
he...
I mean, that's not what it...
Oh, okay.
I
understand why he's kneeling, because there is still a lot of institutional racism against African Americans.
I'm glad we have this recorded.
No, but there is. I think that it is more prevalent in some places and less in others. I do think that both sides of this argument can overreact. I think there are members of the Black Lives Matter movement who can...
Great people on both sides, folks. Both sides. Great people.
You know that's not what I'm
great
saying.
Great people, sir.
I have a better Trump impersonation. But whatever. I think that both sides can exaggerate. I think there are too many people on the conservative right who say that there is no problem, that the police never make mistakes, which is totally wrong. But I also think... that the Black Lives Matter movement, on the other hand, can get it wrong by saying that most, if not all, cops hate black people and want to kill them. So I understand why Colin Kaepernick's kneeling.
Broad generalization, but good.
I understand why Colin Kaepernick's kneeling, and I respect his devotion to what he believes, even though I may disagree with it in some ways. I also think that the NFL, as a private organization, has every right to fine him, to suspend him. And they can make that choice. If you have a problem with him kneeling during the national anthem, buy a CD. This is 2018.
Buy a CD.
Buy a recording of the national anthem. Play it in your house before you turn on the game. Wait for after the anthem. Turn on the game, and then you're fine. You can stand and respect the anthem, and you can let Colin Kaepernick respect and do what he'd like in his own way. This is the other thing when conservatives get upset at him. He initially was sitting. But then he spoke to a veteran, and the veteran said it'd be more appropriate if you kneeled. So he's still trying to show respect to this country, and he loves this country, as far as I can tell, which I believe, I think we can agree on. It's just that he has some problems that he wants to voice and wants to bring up, which he has. He has brought up this issue in this debate. So I don't agree with him necessarily on everything he has to say about the issue, but I respect his right to kneel, and I also respect the NFL's right to restrict and get after him because they are a private organization. Nike signing on with him, and that's their decision. This is, I always love it when Republicans and conservatives are all, I love the free market. But then when a free market company does what they'd like, they get villainized, which, you know, everybody can do. What I think is ridiculous is that we have to burn our Nike products. Or, as in the one case,
cutting off the
sock. Cutting off, not even all the sock, just the swoosh. Just the swoosh. So I think it's ridiculous. Yeah, you've already given them your money. Yeah. If you want to get rid of your Nike stuff, donate it to somebody who needs it. You know, take it to the DI or Goodwill if you're not in Utah or Idaho. So I think it's a bit of an overreaction. Like, they already have your money from products you've already purchased. If you don't want to give them any more, just don't buy Nike. Buy Adidas. Thank you. Jeez. Or New Balance. New Balances are coming back in. So that's just my take. I just think everybody's kind of flipping it, and they don't need to.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with most of what you said. I think it's a bold move by Nike, and I respect him for doing it. When I saw the advertisement the first time, I almost thought it was fake. I thought that there was...
Fake news.
Please.
Fake news.
Please stop.
You are fake news.
I thought it was fake, and I respect him for taking the risk. And it'll be interesting. I mean, we've seen some of the fallout already by, users on Twitter with... what was the one? I retweeted something. It was like, @SecondAmendmentLover, #TCOT, and like those people, and they're cutting off their socks.
Socks useless, because like the top part of the socks is the part like scrunches.
Right. But what is everybody talking about right now? Talking about Nike. So... I think it's a good business move. I think it's a bold business move by Nike. And again, I wholeheartedly respect Colin Kaepernick for doing what he's doing. And I think what people often overlook is the risk that he took in his own career to do this. Because while Colin Kaepernick is no, top 10 quarterback in the NFL, I mean, he took a team to the Super Bowl.
I wouldn't say top 100.
He's certainly in the top 100 of quarterbacks in the NFL. He took a team to the Super Bowl, Clint. He was in the Super Bowl.
It's a team effort.
Anyways.
Tom Brady, though.
Anyways. He was one throw away from winning a Super Bowl.
Tom Brady went from down like 23.
We can talk about Brady and his politics another time.
Oh, I love Tom Brady.
But, so...
I just want
mad respect to Colin Kaepernick.
For the most part, I don't understand why people get so up in bunches about what businesses do politically. For me, like, the only time I've ever really not patronized a business is because if they do things that I view are essentially human rights violations, whereas Nike just wanting to sign with a athlete, a respected athlete, well, respected by some, I still like my Nikes. Still feel comfy. Colin Kaepernick being a representative for Nike doesn't make my Nike shoes any less comfy.
Sure. Well, in my, I'll somewhat disagree with that take because I think that one of the best forms of speech that we have is how we spend our money.
Wait. Can you say that one more time?
What?
Say that one more time. The best forms.
One of the best forms of speech we have is how we spend our money.
Okay. I just wanted that on tape.
Okay. People get upset. In-N-Out has been in the news recently because they found out that, In-N-Out has been giving money to Republicans.
But their burgers still slap.
Their burgers are good, and it's your decision to eat there or not. But I think that one of the best ways you can protest a business if you disagree with their decisions is to not eat there.
For
sure. And it doesn't matter what they do. If you disagree with it, then don't use their products. Don't eat there.
That's the beauty of capitalism.
Okay. And that's American society. And I think...
It's capitalism.
You gotta throw the C word in there, man. Just kidding. I don't know. I've seen a lot of backlash on social media to people who decide not to spend their money because of political takes, because you don't want to let politics take over your life. But, I mean, you know.
Politics is everywhere.
It's everywhere. And this is the real world. And if you disagree with the company's stance on an issue or who they give their money to or how they treat their workers or whatever, then it's absolutely your right and your prerogative to not spend money there.
So I'm the only Republican, really, in our house. Well,
that's not true.
The most vocal one. But if, like, somebody was burning something as a protest, I'd be more mad at them for burning something in our house, like rubber or leather, than I would be that they were protesting something.
I wouldn't put it past Ian, but, you know.
I mean, I wouldn't either, but...
Anyways, let's move on here really quick. We're going to try to wrap up the show fairly quickly, but really quickly, right now, the Senate race in Texas is getting close. It's getting close. There's a poll. I can go on RCP right now.
RCP. A poll. Real Clear Politics.
I can go to Real Clear Politics right now.
Okay, I'm going to pull 538.
Please do. And, you know, a bright red Senate
not
seat.
Not going to.
A bright red Senate seat has slowly faded. And in the eyes of most political scientists, the research I've done, it's gone from solid Republican to lean Republican to now getting close to a toss-up. Poll release, I think it was by Marist the other day. Here it is. Emerson had Ted Cruz with just a 1-point lead on Beto O'Rourke. And so it's a tight race, and I think this is another interesting dilemma here where we have a very progressive Democrat in a southern state. Is it West? I don't know. It's southern West. I don't know.
It's not the West.
But it's not really the South either, right?
It's its own abomination.
You're not a Texas guy, Clint?
It's all right. It's not
a hot take.
Boy, they,
Texas is supposed to be like your.
No,
that's supposed to be your place, man.
No, they think that they're the West. The West doesn't start until you hit Colorado. They're at best the Midwest.
Texas, okay.
Wow. Boy, the West. West is Nevada, Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Idaho.
So we've got.
If you're not there, you're not.
So
the West.
We've got a poll from Emerson that has Cruz with a 1-point lead. NBC News has Cruz with a 4-point lead. University of Texas has Cruz with a 2-point lead. So polls are certainly tightening. And I, you know, Clint, you and I have both taken Michael Lyon's classes, a philosophy on Ted Cruz, how much of a nuisance he is in the United States Senate. I don't know if I've really gotten your full take on Ted Cruz, but if he lost, it would be an absolutely massive upset. Ted Cruz, you know, did he come in second in the 2016 Republican race?
The primary?
In the primary. I feel like, I think he was in second.
Yeah, I don't know. There were so many candidates.
Anyways, a front runner for the 2016 Republican nomination. This would be a massive upset. Again, if you're a Democrat, don't want to get too excited because, again, it is Texas, very, very conservative demographic, although you know, the demographics in Texas are changing. Swung towards Hillary, I think, +8 from 2012 in the last election. So... again, maybe in the future it'll be more competitive, but what is your take on the race?
Ted Cruz is a nuisance, but
there we go.
He will win. There is no doubt in my mind that Ted Cruz will serve another 6 years as the Republican senator from Texas. Hold on.
Okay, sorry.
Beto, is that how you say it?
Beto.
Beto likes to claim that he's the Spanish candidate, you know, that he represents Hispanic America.
Watch yourself.
It's not true, though. It's not true.
Where has he claimed that he is a...
Hasn't he said...
a Spanish candidate.
He's like, hasn't he reached out and said, I represent Hispanic Texas.
I'd like to see you saying that. I'm saying, I think, and if that is the image he's trying to produce, he's not trying to say that he is Hispanic. He's trying to say that he represents the interests of those voters... better than the current senator.
How?
I'm not speaking for him. I'm just letting you know what he's saying.
Okay.
Obviously, he's saying through progressive politics, through immigration reform, obviously big in Texas. You know, Ted Cruz basically sold out and is now on the Trump train. Would you disagree? Would you disagree?
Wow, is that the quote?
Donald Trump called him lying Ted for 9 months, and then there's a picture of Ted Cruz at a Donald Trump office making calls. I'd call that selling out, wouldn't you? Yeah, that's what I thought. So, again, I'm not going to get too excited about it. That being said...
because you're going to lose.
I think there's a good chance Ted Cruz will probably win.
No, Ted Cruz is bad for the U.S. Senate in the sense that that filibuster, what was that, 8 years ago? Maybe even less. 6? Where he got up in, like, red Dr. Seuss. That was the worst. That was the worst. That was the absolute... That's what... that's where I was first like, maybe the Republican Party isn't perfect, but it is. I'm just kidding, it isn't.
What did John Boehner say about him?
I don't know. John Boehner's a legend, though.
I gotta look that up. John Boehner's an interesting guy. I need to look that up. Because what did he call, like, Ted Cruz, like a...
Did he call him the Zodiac Killer?
Lucifer in the flesh.
Lucifer in the flesh, that's right.
So if you've got, I mean, and...
If you've got the former Speaker of the American House of Representatives calling Ted Cruz...
We also called him a miserable son of a bitch, too. So, again, not well-liked on either side of the aisle, and I think there may even be some Republicans who are, wouldn't be especially moderate Republicans, who wouldn't be terribly upset if he was no longer.
I mean, I wouldn't be terribly upset. I wouldn't be happy, though, that we've got Beto, but sure. Here's my thing.
Give me your thing.
Beto wins 2018. 2024 rolls around. It's a presidential election year. He will lose. Because most likely by 2024, you will have a Democrat come into the White House, and Texans will say, well, gosh darn it, we can't have no Democrat in our Senate seat. That's my Texas accent.
Okay. Anyways, I think we're going to go ahead and wrap up the show for today.
Yeah.
Covered some good topics. Clint, hope you enjoyed your first episode.
I did.
Folks, if you want to come on the show, we're trying to create some sort of list. A short list of sorts. If you'd like to be a guest to talk about some things. My name is Sam Jackson. Once again, my Twitter name is @SamNJackson.
I'm Clint Bisbee, and my Twitter name is @Clint_Bisbee.
The biz. Again, thank you guys for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed the first episode, and we'll be coming back at you next week with some more spicy hot takes. Thank you for listening, everyone.